Studio 360 is supported by 23andMe. The DNA kit from 23andMe is designed to provide more than 200 personalized health reports and the knowledge to make informed decisions about personal health. A personalized DNA kit is available at 23andMe.com/Studio360.
Today in Studio 360, big data is here to stay. So what does it have to tell us about our culture?
Well, you're always looking for cultural indicators. Everybody can talk about the decline or rise of some culture or another, but you're looking for data.
Plus, if a soldier had 6 seconds to show you his world, what would he do?
You want to see what Afghanistan looks like?
We got dirt.
We got piles of dirt. What's that over there? F***ing dirt.
Soldiers using a cell phone video app to bring us into war zones.
As people adapt to tools, they become more professional at them. People are starting to document things rather than tell narrative stories.
And the writer Sue Grafton, whose 23rd mystery novel starring Kinsey Millhone comes out next month. I am Kurt Anderson. That and much more is ahead in Studio 360 today from PRI and WNYC, right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC with modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look. The Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Most artists work and work their entire lives and never get close to rich or famous. Then there's Kenneth Goldsmith.
I was showing in the best galleries, showing internationally. I was making a fortune. And one day I woke up and said, this is not what I wanted to be an artist for. I laid off everybody and began looking for another way to be.
Goldsmith found his other way to be through poems. And now he's the first ever poet laureate at New York's Museum of Modern Art. We'll hear about one of the works that inspired him later this hour. But first, as it does every summer, Hollywood's been playing it totally safe. You know what I'm talking about. Super expensive and loud would-be blockbusters with numbers at the end of the title.
Minions assemble!
Despicable Me 2. Iron Man 3.
I thought Brazil was our last job.
Fast and Furious 6.
But unlike any previous summer I can think of, it seems there's been another new special effects mega movie in theaters every weekend. And these tent poles and franchises seem to have lost their sure thingness. In the past few months, maybe $1 billion worth of movie making. The Lone Ranger, After Earth, White House Down, The Wolverine, Pacific Rim, Smurfs 2, totally bombed in America. And that's not even counting advertising campaigns that cost maybe another billion. Linda Obst has been producing films in Hollywood for 30 years, ones mostly about humans, not monsters or robots. And she is the author of the new book, Sleepless in Hollywood, about what she calls the new abnormal in the movie business. Linda Obst, welcome to Studio 360.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So it really seems that the major studios doubled down on blockbusters this summer as never before. Is this just the next step and finally it will all tumble down on them?
Well, it's not clear that it will all tumble down on them unless they learn no lessons. And it's a very reactive, bright crew of people. But it has been pretty catastrophic for the movie business.
And if you're running a studio, why you do XYZ 2 and ABC 7 and all these sequels and big movies that they think every 20-year-old kid's going to see is driven by fear. But doesn't this failure of that formula make them even more fearful?
Actually, the ones with the 7 after them,
yeah.
Those are the successful ones.
I guess that's right.
If it's made it to the 7th iteration, that's the good news. Let's look at Fast and Furious.
Right.
Fast and Furious opens well and does well, both domestically and in the international market.
And international box office now, as one looks at these movies, big movies certainly, accounts for most of the money they're taking in at this point, right?
and not only accounts for most of the money, 80% of the box office is now from the international market, but is the reason that you're seeing this glut of huge, big-budget special effects pictures. And that's sort of the definition of the new abnormal. When you know that 80% of your profits is coming from international, you want to give the rest of the world what they want. We're only, you know, 2% of the world.
Right, right.
When I sort of discovered this fact, that was what I feared. We no longer count, we in the domestic U.S. English-speaking market. But what you see this summer is that the total failure of a movie in the U.S. market doesn't behoove it well for its eventual success overseas.
So we in the United States seeing movies have become kind of a large focus group for the rest of the world, right?
Yes, I think that's true. The studios do care if a movie is a flop here, even if it really performs overseas, it's less likely to get another $250 million mounting.
What about these fresh, original films that get made that are in some sense, well, like Woody Allen certainly has been trying his whole career to make what is we used to think of as a European kind of film. When Americans make those, they just don't do business in foreign countries?
Certainly Russia and China won't even open our movies like that. China won't let them in. In the quotas from China, they literally will only let in 3D and IMAX movies by law and design. So it's not that the studios are guessing that that's all that the big markets want. They're being told that that's all the big markets want.
Why? Because they want to protect their domestic Sleepless in Seattle movies?
Yes, that's partially the reason. And second, they don't want the infiltration of our ideas. And who knows how they can sneak in, even though they have a propaganda ministry cutting, you know, wildly through our movies in case there is, you know, an accidental infiltration of an idea or some kind of statement about the Chinese or something that they may not like. But we're not there to exchange cultural nuance. Our movies aren't there for that. Our movies are there to showcase our fabulous technology.
Do you think next summer will be the same, only more, or will there be, have we just seen the peak of cynical giant blockbusters that they think will make money overseas?
Well, it's hard to change next summer so quickly because tent poles are in the pipeline already. But on the other hand, I see in development more originals this year. That I hope the studios will see as an opportunity to, instead of making the one marginal tentpole for $250 million that you're just not sure about making that feels somewhat familiar, but everybody kind of thinks, this could work in Hong Kong, you know?
Right.
Dump that one and make five smaller movies, you know? And save a little money for development next year to buy a great script.
Well, on that glimmer of hope, Linda Obst, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Kurt.
Linda Obst is a film and TV producer in Los Angeles. Her new book is Sleepless in Hollywood, Tales from the New Abnormal in the Movie Business. So what do you think? Does Hollywood need to rethink its blockbuster tentpole strategy? Will it? Or is it just giving the people of Earth what they want? Leave us a comment at studio360.org. All summer, we asked you to send us the music you made with your friends while you were teenagers. We got more than 300 songs submitted by 50 years worth of high school bands, and in a couple of weeks, we'll reveal the winner. In the meantime, we've got the mixtape we promised you. Actually, we've got two because the submissions were that good. You can find our Battle of the High School Bands mixtapes, Volume 1 and 2, tunes by Bonsai Trees, The Rabies, The Olsen Twins, Cacha Bacha, and many more at studio360.org. I know we're high school prey. I got that treehouse made. Years ago, Sue Grafton published a mystery novel called A is for Alibi. The book sold enough copies to justify B is for burglar and then C is for corpse. By the time she was at G is for gumshoe, the Alphabet series, starring a tomboyish private detective named Kinsey Millhone, had become a reliably best-selling franchise. Earlier this year, I talked with Sue Grafton about her collection of short stories called Kinsey and Me, meant to tide readers over until next month's W is for Wasted. Sue Grafton, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being with you.
So there are tens of millions of copies of all of your books about Kinsey Millhone out in the world. But for listeners who aren't yet acquainted, tell us a little bit about her.
Well, when I began this series in 1982, she was 32 years old. She has been married and divorced twice. She owns one dress. She cuts her hair with a pair of nail scissors. Cusses like a soldier. Very down to earth and has a very wicked eye when it comes to observing human nature.
So she's kind of an every woman, except that she runs several miles every day and solves crimes.
She jogs. It isn't running. Even she would admit that. But she eats a lot of junk food, which I can no longer do myself.
When the first one came out in the early 80s, it was kind of a big deal because your detective was this woman, this young, tough, modern woman. Did you have a sense as you embarked on this that the time was ripe and maybe overripe for such a detective in fiction?
No, I can't claim any prescience. I can't claim I was even aware. I just didn't realize there were no female private investigators. I was raised reading male hard-boiled private detectives. So when it came time to write a mystery novel, a crime novel of my own, my only thought was to play the central part myself. Because I was already out of my element. I didn't know what a private investigator did. I had to read up on police procedure and California criminal law and ballistics and toxicology. So I figured my only area of expertise was being female, and I better take advantage.
You started writing the Kinsey Millhone novels as a means, I read, to escape a successful career in TV writing, which is usually with the opposite of how it usually goes, where people who can't make money writing novels say, okay, I'm going to go into show business now. But you didn't like making a lot of money in Hollywood.
No. Well, I had done a stint in Hollywood because my second published novel, which is called The Lolly Madonna War, sold to Hollywood, and that was made into a film that came out in 1973. Fabulous cast. It was Rod Steiger and Robert Ryan. And
the young Jeff Bridges, right?
Yes, indeed. It was really a wonderful cast. It was a wonderful experience. I learned a lot in Hollywood, but I am just not a team player. I do not like to write by committee, and I don't like help. So in Hollywood, if you're not interested in collaboration, you just have no business being there. And it took me a while to figure that out.
Whereas writing novels, you are in control. You're the screenwriter. You're the director. You're everything.
I know, which is good news and the bad. When the work is going well, there's nothing better. When I'm stuck, I wouldn't mind having a small committee at my feet to help me through the rough passages.
There has never been an American TV series or movie version of Kinsey Millhone. How come?
Oh, well, for the very reasons I just detailed. I worked in Hollywood for 15 years, and I was guilty of adaptations, probably trashing the work of writers far better than I. I know what they can do. I know how destructive that system can be. For one thing, the first time that character is cast and an actress steps into that role, half my readers will be outraged, and I will also. Plus, they don't buy a book. They buy the rights to the character. And even in 1982, here's how those contracts read. They buy a character throughout the universe in perpetuity in technologies known and technologies yet to be invented. It's like, don't think so.
So you leave that money on the table knowing you're paying some financial price, but...
It's no price at all. I tell you, my peace of mind and my good nature are worth quite a bit of money. I just don't want that system coming after me.
This A is for, B is for, C is for thing was clearly a brilliant scheme to invent, to start out with 30 years ago. Have you regretted it ever along the way of, oh, my God, I got to get to Z?
In some respects, looking back, I think what nerve, what cheek I had at the age of late 30s when I started that book, thinking I could do 26 novels.
Yeah.
For one thing, I had not even sold A is for Alibi. I sold that book on the basis of 65 pages, never having written a mystery in my life. So I was flying by the seat of my pants. And when A was published, I had no guarantee that there would be a B is for Burglar, let alone C is for Corpse, D is for Deadbeat, and on down the line.
And how sad it would have been if you'd ended with E or F.
Exactly. I was happy to get through those letters. I was always waiting for them to say F is for failure. So yeah. I was really happy.
D is for done.
In fact, there was a review of B is for Burglar that said B is for boring. And I thought I would faint. However, I did survive that wicked comment.
I really don't envy you having to come up with X and Z.
I know. X, see, I am hoping that by the time I write X, somebody will invent an entirely new crime. I hope it's going to be really good and juicy and nasty. And then I can just set out on that road.
Maybe. Well, there's some drugs, you know, Xanax or...
Yeah, Xanax, the killer Xanax.
So in you know, 3 years, you're going to be done. Do you have plans for post-Kinsey Millhone novels, or is that it?
It's going to be 8 years. It's been taking me 2 years per book. So when I get to X, I'll start that in 8 months after I get out of the institution they check me into for finishing this book, you know, after I get my meds adjusted. And I don't know what X is. I don't have a clue. I know even less about Y and Z, but surely something will occur to me between now and then. And after that, I will be close to 80 years old, and I personally think I should be allowed to take a long nap and then party.
There you go. So like Philip Roth, you're gonna call it quits at 80.
I don't think so, because I don't know what else I would do with my life. I agonize through these books, and I pray, it's like every day, please let me get to the end of this book. Then I get to the end of the book, and I have about 4 days of wild freedom. I can go to the grocery store, like at 10 in the morning. And after I do that for about 3 days, I think, this is so boring. You know, it's like life has no meaning and no purpose, so I have to come back to my machine.
So I guess it's like Dr. Johnson in London. When you're tired of writing, you're tired of life, and you're not tired of life yet.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Sue Grafton, thank you very much.
Thank you. This has been fun.
Sue Grafton's new novel is W is for Wasted. It comes out in September, and you can hear an excerpt at studio360.org.
The more you live is the more you learn. The more you live is the more you learn. The more you live is the more you learn. The more you live.
Coming up, big data is giving us all sorts of new insights into the ways we behave, including the stuff that really matters.
One little example that comes to mind is, for instance, Dunkin' Donuts. They spell donut D-O-N-U-T, but there's another alternate spelling of donut, D-O-U-G-H-N-U-T.
You mean the correct spelling of donut?
Yes, exactly. The correct spelling of donut for those of us who are donut strict constructionists. Anyway, so that's a basic question. When did people start spelling it D-O-N-U-T?
Tracking our culture, even donut culture, with the help of big data. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC with modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look. The Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com. And by 23andMe. 23andMe provides a personal DNA kit so individuals can better understand how their genes impact health, which helps individuals and their doctors find health areas to keep an eye on. And 23andMe also gives ancestry information and helps discover personal global origins or perhaps find living relatives. The personal DNA kit, designed to give individuals more control over their personal health, available at 23andme.com/studio360.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. We've all got our own internet rabbit holes.
Oh, Mr. Rabbit, wait!
Places on the web where we find ourselves wandering for hours.
Good night!
Starting a couple of years ago, Google's Ngram viewer became one of mine. You know how Google has digitized millions of books published over the last five centuries? Well, with their Ngram app, you can look up any word or phrase to instantly graph how frequently it was used during any period of time. For instance, I hate the way these days more and more nouns are being turned into verbs.
Juice? You want me to juice?
Such as, how will that impact you? So I made an Ngram to track impacting and discovered that it started taking off, no surprise, in the anything goes 1970s. Geek and nerd started proliferating around 1980.
Nerd!
But with Ngram, I discovered that geek was slower to take off and then, around 2000, overtook nerd.
I prefer the term film geek.
In other words, I regularly and totally geek out on Ngram. The app was invented by a pair of young mathematicians, Jean-Baptiste Michel and Erez Lieberman Aden. They told some of the origin story in a TEDx talk.
Everyone knows that a picture is worth 1,000 words. But we at Harvard were wondering if this was really true.
It started in 2005 in Harvard's giant old main library. Michelle and Aden had been poring over books for more than a year for a linguistics project. Aden says that one day they noticed a book they were using in the library showed up on the internet.
And we thought that that was very strange because no one had taken this book out of the library for decades.
It was when Google was just ramping up its digital online library of every book ever published. Michelle and Aden saw an opportunity. If a computer could scan all the books for their research, they could save months or years of time. And who knows what they might find. Voila, Ngram.
It is a way for anybody to see how frequently any word or short phrase was used year by year for the last 200 years in our culture.
They launched it in 2010, and like I said, it's addictive. For instance, type in women and men, and you can pretty much see when the women's movement began. Women starts to spike in the 1960s, then surpasses men in the 80s, and falls behind again in 2005. In their TED talk, Aden explains how people use Ngrams for all kinds of research, like the guy who looked at how the word arg is spelled with various different numbers of A's.
This person was interested in the history of frustration. If you stub your toe, that's a 1A arg. If the planet Earth is annihilated by the Vogons to make room for an interstellar bypass, that's an 8A arg.
And because the Ngram shows changes in word frequency over time and in different languages, it can also unearth curious gaps.
If you take Marc Chagall or Pablo Picasso, Kandinsky, or virtually any intellectual, especially Jewish, especially artists, and you add, and you look for the trajectories of their names in books published in German, you will see huge dips, holes, really, literally, at about the time of the Nazi regime. So you can visually see the thumb of oppression pressing down the trajectories of these people.
Michelle and Aden decided that their new data-driven mapping of culture needed a scientific name. So they called it
culture omics, based on like genomics, you know, genetics plus omics becomes genomics.
Culture omics is just one way big data is making its way into traditionally less mathy fields. What's called digital humanities is a real academic growth industry right now. Daniel Edelstein's a French professor at Stanford, where he and a team created what he calls a kind of Facebook for the Enlightenment.
What I like to say is that our visualizations are great at giving you a very blurry picture of what might have been.
Their database consists of tens of thousands of letters written by intellectuals like Voltaire, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and Jonathan Swift during the 1700s, what was even then called the Republic of Letters. That correspondence was an important way new ideas could spread through Europe and around the world. Edelstein and his team have created maps that visualize how the letters flowed across countries and continents. He says there were some surprises. Voltaire is known for being influenced by his English contemporaries. But the maps that Edelstein and his team made showed something different.
Where are the letters to England? There's such a myth around Voltaire as having transmitted English thoughts about politics, about philosophy, about science into France, and there was just this gaping hole on the map of his correspondence.
Edelstein says this finding has led to a research project that will try to explain the hole. In the end, he says that working with code and data is not what he expected to be doing as a professor of 18th century French culture. Same goes for lots of scholars. Not just Stanford, but Northwestern, Arizona State, Georgia Tech, the University of Nebraska, all have digital humanities labs now. Erez Lieberman-Aden and Jean-Baptiste Michel say that technology can open up academic research to the independently curious, people like me, like you. But Michel says it's still important that bona fide experts are the ones interpreting the research.
I think it's inevitable that a tool like that will generate a large number of discussions that are actually irrelevant or wrong, just flat out wrong. But at the same time, I think it's also good that a tool that's at the leading edge of science can generate so much enthusiasm in the general public.
And Aden says that putting the n-gram in the hands of the public also means some less consequential but still interesting linguistic questions get answered.
One, you know, little example that comes to mind is, for instance, Dunkin' Donuts.
Time to make the donuts.
They spell donut D-O-N-U-T. But there's another alternate spelling of donut, D-O-U-G-H-N-U-T.
You mean the correct spelling of donut?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. The correct spelling of donut for those of us who are donut-strict constructionists. Anyway, so that's a basic question. When did people start spelling it D-O-N-U-T? And, you know, you might have a whole bunch of ideas. I mean, for instance, Teddy Roosevelt suggested a whole bunch of spelling standardizations that, among other things, would have changed D-O-U-G-H-N-U-T to D-O-N-U-T in order to simplify the English language. But many people responded exactly as you did and said, well, but that's completely incorrect and you just, you know, can't make force everyone to spell things wrong. And in fact, it didn't stick.
That was in 1906. No spike in the graph for D-O-N-U-T. Where you do see a spike is around 1950, the same year as an ambitious bakery opened in Boston.
Well, it seems like that's roughly contemporaneous with the creation of Dunkin' Donuts. So it's really this powerful international brand that led to a common alternate spelling for this particular pastry.
Which I guess is why Cronuts has no U-G-H in it.
If I want to answer to the question, I just type it in the Google. Yeah. The information age could lead me to my chicken noodles.
Erez right? Lieberman-Aden and Jean-Baptiste Michel say that harnessing the words we've used is one of the greatest untapped resources of academic research. The two of them have a book coming out later this year about what they call this revolution in data. It's called Uncharted: Big Data as a Lens on Human Culture. Meanwhile, we've got a big data challenge for you all. Using Google's n-gram viewer, search a word, a phrase, a name, or whatever combination of words or phrases or names you want. Send us your single best discovery, the most surprising or provocative or otherwise fascinating nugget you unearth, and we might call you to be on the air. Your deadline is Thursday, August 15th. You can get started right now at studio360.org. 100% publishing. Big data. And a special thanks to Manish Agrawala, our scientific advisor on this segment. One person who's used the N-gram in his work is David Brooks. In his New York Times column, Brooks recently wrote about how the words we've used less and more over the past half century or so show that as a society, we've become more individualistic. Brooks cited a few different N-gram studies showing how words like self and unique have been on the rise while community and share have declined. When you're trying to parse the rise and fall of civilizations, he says, you're looking for one thing.
You're looking for data. And so one of the big cultural shifts you've seen from these N-grams is a shift from community to individualism, a sharp decline over the really decades in use of words having to do with communal attributes, we, group, community, a large number increase in words having to do with individual agency, I, intend. And so you get pretty sharp social trends. You don't want to read too much into any small little movement in the trends, but when you see a massive shift over decades, you can be pretty sure that we've moved from a community that's much more communally oriented to a community that says, I'm pretty much captain of my own ship, master of my own fate.
Right. Some of the words that had become less frequent in one of these studies, like fortitude and humbleness, I wondered if simply that was because those words themselves seem antique and old-fashioned, or bravery even. I mean, people may admire bravery, but it seems uncool to talk about it. But maybe that's the point.
Yeah, I'd say that's the point. Fortitude, I give you. That does sound to me like an archaic word. Bravery does not. If you go back to social indicators, and what you're trying to do is link these bits of evidence to broader things you notice in the historical record. And so, for example, if you go back to Princeton in the 1920s, they had a theory of how to create men of character, and then it was an all-male school. And what they did was they took rich young boys, mostly from old blue blood families, and they toughened them up. They would have this institution called a snowball fight between the freshman and sophomore class each winter, which was really a rock fight. This was part of an effort to toughen people up and to instill courage in them, which was seen as the primary of the virtues. So I do think it matches the historical record that we're less courage-oriented and we're probably more into the cooperative virtues.
Now, with these kind of big data looks, analyses, I mean, one begins with hypotheses. You know, you have a set of beliefs about America and how we are or aren't going to hell, and presumably these academics do as well. Is that sort of a problem with such things, is that you can pick your cherries and now you have the big data ability to pick your cherries?
That is true. But I think what we do is there are some things data can do for us, some things observations can do for us. And you're looking to test one versus the other. And so I think if we look at cultural trends, a lot of what we're inevitably and properly going to rely on is our sensations as we go about our lives, mm-hmm. as we look at books, as we feel things. But you do have to be prepared for surprises. So one of the surprises I found in other work I've done is I thought people who used the word I a lot were more likely to be prideful and narcissistic than people who didn't, who were more self-forgetting or self-effacing. That turns out to be the opposite of the truth. People who are completely egomaniacal and narcissistic are so confident of themselves, they actually don't use the word I a lot. They actually use the word I less. So you do have to test your intuitions against data and one against the other.
There are many people in the humanities who are objecting to this encroachment into their world of close reading and close looking by data. Is that just what academics always do? And should they welcome this as another tool in looking at how culture and art and literature can be examined?
Yeah, I think one of the key things we have to accomplish over the next couple of years is find the limits of both data, of scientism, of economic modeling. In other words, we used to understand ourselves through the prism of the humanities, through the prism of theology, and we would say these are the soft, less data-driven, less mathematical ways of understanding ourselves. Over the last 20 years, we've had many more mathematical ways of understanding ourselves or scientific ways. And it seems to me we have to understand what those things can be used for and what they can't. Data is really good at probability. One of the things our normal intuitions are really bad at math. And so we're really bad at predicting probabilities. Mm-hmm. And so using data for that strikes me as very good. One of the things our normal intuitive mind is really good at, first of all, pattern recognition. Second of all, is evaluating other people. And so understanding what data can do and what it can't do seems to me the primary job of the next couple of years. My problem with the humanities is that they've become a little too insecure about threats from what the neurosciences might do to them, as if they're going to replace the humanities. And believe me, understanding the synapses will never help us explain the creation of Macbeth or Othello. And to me, the humanities are in decline because they've lost their core mission. They've spent too much time talking about race, class, and gender, too much time talking about social repair, not enough time talking about internal improvement, internal redemption. And if they're going to abandon their core mission, then the humanities will continue to decline.
Well said. David Brooks, thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Brooks is a columnist for the New York Times.
Take different shapes.
Still ahead in Studio 360, the digital age is not just giving us the long view from 30,000 feet, it's also providing instant close-up glimpses of things we'd never otherwise see.
Hey, let me shoot this and see what happens. What I get to see, now you can see it.
Vine videos by U.S. troops coming up in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC with modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look. The Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. What can you do in 6 seconds? Tie one of your shoes, say these two sentences, or watch a very short movie. That is the premise of the Twitter app called Vine, recording video and audio lasting no more than 6 seconds. Since the platform launched 7 months ago, millions of users have uploaded tiny films, songs, jokes, life moments. Ike Sriskandaraja is a Vine connoisseur, and while exploring the social network 6 seconds at a time, he realized it can take you to some surprising places.
Every new form of media has its pioneer. Television had the Honeymooners, animation had Walt Disney, and Vine has this guy.
Hello, my name's Nicholas Magalis, and I'm a musician and Viner.
With 2 million followers, Nicholas is kind of a Vine virtuoso. He's here to explain the app. And in the spirit of Vine, Nicholas has agreed to keep his answers to 6 seconds.
Okay, I'm ready for it.
Okay, first off, what is Vine? Ready? Go.
Vine is a social app which incorporates video and audio that is limited to 6 seconds. Oh, I got it exactly in 6 seconds.
The creators of Vine tested shorter lengths and longer lengths and found 6 seconds was just the right amount of time to create, to download, and to watch a video on your phone. Next question. How do you make a Vine?
Get your phone out, think of an idea, shoot it as many times as you're comfortable with, pick the best one, upload it.
Press your thumb down to start recording, lift it to make a cut. You can tap the screen a lot if you want to make a stop motion movie, or hold it down for one continuous shot.
Hey everybody, have you heard the news? I got me a pair of amazing shoes.
Nicholas has uploaded hundreds of Vines, like this one, which is also about footwear.
I got shoe hands. Why don't you go and tell two friends?
And this PSA on personal hygiene.
No, I don't want any damn cavities.
Then there's his magnum opus, which might be the most popular Vine so far.
Yo, my name is Nicholas, and this is ridiculous. Got mad gummy money, and it is delicious.
It's a close-up of Nicholas. Long hair, wide eyes, singing directly into the camera as his wallet, overflowing with gummy worms, comes into view. So, what's the secret to Vine fame?
I posted a lot of weird things, and there's a lot of freaks out there. I'm blown away, but they liked it. Oh, I got it over with 7 seconds. I'll do it again. No, that was it. That was it. That's all we got.
Most of Nicholas's vines are skits and jingles, but he insists that's not all the app is good for.
Somebody said, like, yeah, Vine is such a great comedy app. I think somebody, that was the words they said. And I said, yeah, not really. I mean, it is. Obviously, you could be funny, but you can do whatever you want.
You can tell a good joke in 6 seconds. You can scare someone half to death in 6 seconds. And you can be extremely creative in 6 seconds.
Jenna Terranova is the director of programming at the Tribeca Film Festival. Soon after Vine launched, Tribeca hosted the first 6-second film competition.
We just saw an opportunity to see how people were telling stories with technology. We're always very interested in that. And there were a lot of people, even 2 months out, who were doing it fairly well.
Jenna helped judge hundreds and hundreds of very short films and picked the ones that told the best story. This won for Best Genre Film. We stagger from a dark forest into a shack and see a man tied to a chair. A figure wearing a burlap mask flickers above him and then draws a blade across the man's neck. The screen sprays red, and then it happens again.
In that 6 seconds, it repeats, and it becomes scarier when you're forced to see that looping.
It's all about finding new ways to exploit the medium.
As people adapt to tools, they become more professional at them. So the quality is increasing, and the variety, and more people are doing different things. For example, people are starting to document things rather than tell narrative stories.
Simple documentation can be fascinating on Vine. And the right search words can take you into some real intimate moments and surprising places. The first night I downloaded the app, I searched for fireworks, hashtag mortar. All of a sudden, I found myself in Afghanistan. It was an unfiltered glimpse of military life that we don't usually have access to. And there were others, a whole body of vines capturing all phases of American military life, from weapons training to leaving home.
That moment when you deploy in 1 hour and all you want to do is sleep.
To arriving in combat.
You guys want to see what Afghanistan looks like?
We got dirt.
We got piles of dirt. What's that over there? Dirt.
Vine shows the parts of military service that rarely make it into the news or movies. The routine stuff and the downtime. Michael Cameron has been a soldier for 16 years. He's been stationed in Bosnia and done 4 tours of Afghanistan. Recently, he started sharing some of his experience on Vine. I reached him at his base in Stuttgart, Germany, over a rough Skype connection.
What I get to see, now you can see it. You know, I'm not particularly funny. I can't sing, so it's not really about that.
For Mike, it's about taking vines of the history around him, like an old Nazi building on base, or a large standing section of the Berlin Wall.
I shoot a lot of them when I'm out walking my dog. I'll see something cool or something that I think will interest somebody else. Hey, let me shoot this and see what happens.
A spokesman at the Department of Defense said it's hard to say what members of the military can or can't share over social media. But all personnel have been trained to exercise sound judgment when posting information online. From what I've seen, these active duty vines aren't about state secrets. Unless it's a secret that military life may be less exciting than the movies would have us believe.
Being deployed has its downtime, and there's a lot of it for a lot of guys.
First of all, in Afghanistan, just finished my coffee. Lord as
in the Marines, huh? We love to watch movies.
You got movies on deck, son.
There's something moving in seeing an American teenager in the suburbs and an American teenager in Afghanistan, both vining about being bored.
You get a lot of disconnect between civilians and soldiers, and you know, you get to see these guys in their regular daily lives, you know, sand and mountains and scorching heat and rocket attacks and IED attacks, or this is what our downtime is like, and you're watching 6-second clips of them just horsing around. I think maybe it adds a little more humanity to what it is that we do.
Which may be Vine's most powerful feature. There are similar services, like the new video option on Instagram, which offers a few more seconds but doesn't loop. Whatever mobile platform takes over, it will tap into the same central human need.
We all want to hear and see stories.
Again, Jenna Terranova from Tribeca Films.
In some sense, we're addicted to just that, hearing a story, seeing a story.
The zoetrope might have been the original media, A simple animation stored on a slotted wheel that lasts as long as it's spinning. You see something happen, and then a few seconds later, you see it again. Now, it's just easier for us to keep spinning our wheels. For Studio 360, I'm Mike Sriskandarajan. My one true
vine, you still come to me. Ike Sriskandaraja is a reporter for Turnstile News, a project of Youth Radio. You can see some of the vines mentioned in our story at studio360.org. When the Museum of Modern Art in New York appointed its first poet laureate earlier this year, it chose Kenneth Goldsmith. He works with found texts. That is, he takes bits of writing from different sources and reconstitutes it as poetry, his own poetry. Goldsmith started out as a visual artist in college at the Rhode Island School of Design, then in New York City in the 1980s.
It was the time of the AIDS crisis. And I was making political work that dealt with fear and numbers and death and government and politics. I was making kind of hard political statements. And, you know, I thought that those were effective. But at the same time, I was becoming disillusioned. I mean, there were people that were involved in the AIDS movement that were doing die-ins in front of City Hall and going to jail, which seemed to me to be actually very effective. And so to be a guy kind of, you know, in the studio, I felt like a bit of an armchair activist.
But Goldsmith's sculptures were popular with collectors, and he promptly became successful.
I was showing in the best galleries, showing internationally. I was making a fortune. I had a team of studio assistants. I was barely making my own work. Instead, what I had become was a businessman, which was great at first, and then it became like running a small business. Then one day I woke up and said, this is not what I wanted to be an artist for. I did this so I wouldn't have to become a businessman. And I kind of freaked out and stopped doing what I was doing because I was absolutely miserable. It was a dream to become a wildly successful artist, but watch out what you wish for. I just stopped. I stopped producing art. I laid off everybody and began looking for another way to be. Now, the solution to that way out came in the form of a book that I had perused when I was a student. It was a funny little book by John Cage called Silence. John Cage was the rare mix of musician and philosopher. The philosophers would dismiss him as a musician, and the musicians would dismiss him as a philosopher. Cage basically took a bunch of notes, threw them into a hat, and threw them out onto a musical staff and played them and challenged us to find the beauty in what we had previously dismissed as mere randomness. So I pick up this book by John Cage called Silence, which is a collection of essays that he had published in 1961. He had written these essays some 20 years earlier. So I bought the book and I went home and began reading it and began seeing that there was a whole other way to be an artist in the world other than that which I was taught. He says, I am here and there is nothing to say. If among you are those who wish to get somewhere, let them leave at any moment. What we require is silence, but what silence requires is that I go on talking. So he's abandoning the ego-driven idea that the artist has something to say. Another quote says that very clearly, probably the most famous Cage quote of all. He says, I have nothing to say, and I am saying it, and that is poetry as I need it. Art should be about freedom, but it's often based in fear. Fear of what other people will think, fear of not adequately expressing ourselves. Certainly there was a lot of fear around my production You know, I was trying to assert myself. I thought I had to say a lot. And I was bending over backwards to make big statements. And Cage kind of gave me license back again to become an artist by doing less and saying less and fearing less. So after going through this transformation, I realized that I wanted to be a freer type of artist, which led me to poetry. And so I began just kind of reframing texts that already exist, weather reports.
Now the official 1010 Winds AccuWeather four-day forecast, and meteorologist John Ferrick has a live report.
Breezy and warm for this afternoon, sunshine and some clouds, the high up to 84, pretty nice afternoon for this time of the year.
Currently, winds out of the east at 7 miles per hour, the relative humidity 96%, 58 degrees in Midtown, heading for 66. If we listen to the weather report every day on 1010 Winds, we will find language, you know, swept up in classical ideas of weather and the four seasons and eternity and repetition, all within that 1 minute 1010 Winds weather report. So I took a year of those. I just taped them off the radio for an entire year. I transcribed them and made a very, very beautiful narrative of the four seasons as expressed through commercial radio. Now, you know, I had to get a day job because poetry didn't pay the bills. And I've since never have been able to live on my poetry. But to me, it was that freedom that made me feel like the kind of artist that I needed to be instead of the kind of artist that I thought I should be. You know, it's giving up a kind of control. But when we give up things, we get something else. And I think that's Cage's message.
Kenneth Goldsmith is the first poet laureate at the Museum of Modern Art. Our story was produced by Krista Ripple. Is there some book or song or movie that's had that kind of lasting impact on your life? If so, tell us about it at studio360.org, and we might share your story on the air. And that is it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferum,
Alana Harper,
Anne Hepperman,
Eric Malinsky,
Chloe Plant,
Rick Kwan,
Rachel Lewis Krisky,
Ellen Mayer,
Mark Sheely.
Thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegum. And don't forget about Studio 360's Battle of the High School Bands mixtapes. Now in two volumes, an amazing anthology of music I guarantee you've never heard before. Available free at studio360.org.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC with modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look. The Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com. And by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts. Art works.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, we take the show live on stage with a tough crowd that gives even great performers the jitters.
Every time I get nervous, I start to talk really fast. Nobody can understand nothing I'm saying, which is very frustrating for me, as you can imagine.
Actress-writer Sarah Jones and singer-songwriter Steve Earle join us at the Aspen Ideas Festival. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Farewell, I'm bound to you.